he added. There's not much point in you even trying. In much the same way that I discovered collecting conkers was actually more fun than playing with them, I took to collecting worms with more enthusiasm and early success than catching big perch. Of course, Grandad had me pegged, totally. I had heard the best time to look for the biggest worms was in the dead of night, just after a summer storm, preferably on the outfield of a cricket pitch. That seemed like a ludicrous number of variables to me, and with nighttime cricket matches in the rain, particularly thin on the ground in my patch of Cambridgeshire, I took to recreating a rainstorm with a washing-up bowl filled with fairy liquid suds and the tactical deployment of a gently wiggled garden fork. Once I got it right, it was like raising Medusa's hair from the turf. Up the worms would pop en masse, no doubt poisoned from their homes by the sudden influx of soap, and I would scoop them up and into my bait tin with unbridled glee. 1 week later, the largest and juiciest of all my incarcerated lobworms landed within an inch of a big creek perch's mouth with a resounding thump. It was the stealth equivalent of hiding behind a door for an hour to quietly surprise your mate and then slapping him round the face with a draft excluder the second he walked into the room. Naturally, the big perch flushed immediately from its hole in fright, leaving me sat impotently watching my giant worm squirm its way along the bottom without a single fish anywhere else in sight. What was it about these cursed bloody worms? Perch holes and playgrounds. Lobworms seemed to clear them both with ruthless efficiency. For 30 seconds I waited, roasting from the inside out with a furious impatience. How did Grandad do it? When I did give up, I made sure I gave the turf the most solid kick I had in me before heading straight home to catch more worms, swearing blind that day I would never bother trying to catch big perch ever again. After the sand eel was lost and the Wilson Encyclopedia found, it made sense to me to start my quest with big perch. Not just because they had such a presence in my childhood, but also because it was a perch that had slowly begun to ease me off my carp addiction in the months before the sand eel hammer blow. It started with a few speculative casts with a worm a couple of years ago, purely to fill in the time when the carp weren't biting. I wasn't expecting anything to happen, but to my sheer delight, my float zipped away with a familiar jagging riposte, and I found the swarms of little perch had been dutifully waiting for me, almost as if they'd been following me around since I was a little boy. With a bit more managed neglect of my carp rod, a slightly bigger hook, and the careful chumming of the water with broken lobworm, I soon found I could even winkle out the odd larger perch in the shoal. Okay, they weren't that big, perhaps only a pound or so, but I was at least aware that these were indeed the striped monsters of my childhood memories, and so venerated them sufficiently. The following year, I made my first concerted effort to target even bigger perch. I did some research, modified my tackle, and shipped in 200 live lobworms that I established in a garden shed bucket and fattened up on vegetable scraps. Within the year, I had my first 2-pound fish, a stunning, bristling specimen that scrapped all the way to my net in a heart-stopping account of itself. As I held it in my hands, I felt a sort of electrical pulse of excitement that I hadn't experienced since I was a boy. Just why had I wasted the last 20 years fishing almost exclusively for one species of fish? I slipped her back, the dorsal, slicing the water like a serrated knife through an apple, and would meet the sand eel on my very next trip out. In the past 20 years of fishing almost exclusively in stocked carp lakes, I had inadvertently stumbled across a very modern phenomenon. With commercial carp waters sprouting up all over Britain, big perch have found a habitat where they can absolutely thrive. In these lakes, there are generally no pike present to cull their numbers or compete for the bait fish, and barely any angling pressure from the hordes of cyclopean fishermen targeting only carp. As a result, the perch in these ponds have been allowed to grow to prodigious proportions. Out of the biggest 50 perch caught in Britain, nearly half have come from commercially stocked lakes in the last decade. A staggering result that is hardly matched in any other fish species mentioned in this book. Year on year, the established perch records are being pressed, and even the 3-pound Wilson mega specimen has seemingly become a happy resident in almost every carp pond you care to mention. You shouldn't be foolish enough to think that that means they are easy to catch. Big perch will always continue to play their cards very close to their chest, and only the best of anglers will regularly snare the largest specimens. It took me 2 winters' worth of outings before I had my first decent one, and another year before I had a brush with my very own perch of a lifetime, right here, at the very venue whose gates I was swinging into. White Springs is pretty much your blueprint for any commercial pond complex you care to pick in the country. It's got a variety of man-made lakes offering everything from pleasure fishing for carp over double figures, right up to a specimen lake with carp over 45 pounds stirring up the waters. So far, so similar. However, what really set my pulse racing were the reports of the resident perch in one of the ponds. They sounded mega, even by the high standards of this golden age of perch fishing. I read an article where the author details snaring not one, but 3 perch over 3 pounds in a single session here, which he then topped off with a truly ridiculous fish of over 4 pounds. Surely, I thought, this had to be one of the greatest big perch hauls in history. But a few clicks of the mouse proved these ponds had even more to give. A fish of over 5 pounds is resident here. I've seen its picture. It's a brooding, menacing predator with huge flanks and an appetite to match. 3-pounders, 4-pounders, and even a 5. If you were to place that against carp, it would be the equivalent of having a lake holding a fish over 55 pounds with a head of fish over 40 pounds as a backup. It would be among the most celebrated fishing lakes in the country. Yet, as I roll down the tarmac road and into the complex, it becomes apparent that I'm going to be fishing the perch ponds almost completely on my own. I settle right back into the swim where I lost the big one the previous season. It's on a lake known as the Big Pit, an area of water where the White Springs management have fused 2 lakes together, removing the earthen bank between one lake, which resembled a small canal and held some of the big perch, and another, larger, rounder pond that housed some of the bigger carp. I have to avoid those carp at all costs now. My perch tackle is light, so a hookup with one of the lake's golden mud pigs will necessitate a long and laborious fight, which I'm most likely to lose. Plus, it will certainly scare off any of the big perch that I'm hoping to persuade to my hook. This cold front will do me a real favour in that respect. Carp really don't like the colder months, but there's still a chance I might snare one that's ignoring the forecast. So, to boost my chances further, I'm avoiding all the baits I would commonly use to target carp. Pellets, corn and boilies. And I'm also steering well clear of any parts of the pond where the carp might still be active. The warmer, shallower areas which get more of the limited sunlight. And those fishing platforms which have seen a lot of regular angling activity and feeding. This still might not be enough though. So I'll also be ready to cut right back on my loose feed of red maggots and broken worms if it looks like I'm attracting the unwanted attention of the Cyprinus carpio. Make no mistake, this is a seriously challenging prospect given the intensity of my addiction to that species. A bit like offering a free cigarette to a recently reformed chain smoker. But if I'm going to take this challenge seriously, I have to focus my mind solely on the perch. This corner of the pond absolutely screams perch. It's the area with the thickest banks of marginal reeds, the largest overhanging bushes, and, if my depth plummet isn't lying to me, the deepest, darkest holes around. I can almost feel that big perch's presence, pressed up, somewhere in the darkness, tight against the sunken tree roots and reeds, perfectly camouflaged, waiting to strike me down with those wild black eyes. I begin by scooping a dozen red maggots into my catapult. I'm aiming to keep these going in every minute or so. Hopefully, the little but often feeding routine will bring into the swim the shoals of little bait fish that the bigger perch like to feed on. If that fails, I've got the crutch of these broken lobworms to rest back on. Chopping them up into pieces will release a slick of worm's blood into the swim. Catnip for the big perch. The scent will draw them in. Then they'll find all the bait fish. Then bang. They'll inhale my irresistible bait. I hook a juicy lobworm through the tail and give it an underhand flick right into the dark shadows at the foot of the reeds. I'll have to be vigilant. Any signs of scattering baitfish or big swirls could well be the perch's dinner bell sounding. I may only get one chance to snare a really large one. Gently, I tighten the line between my hook, the weight and my rod tip, till I can register a bite simply by watching for any minute movement at the end of my rod. Satisfied, I settle back into my chair and immediately hook into a massive carp. For fuck's sake! The rod arches down to breaking point and the reel screams in deference as the fish ploughs directly between two small islands. I tighten everything down as much as I dare and apply side pressure. My rod forms an almost perfect parabola. Hold it, Will, just hold it. If it gets behind the islands, it's game over. The line winds in the wind. I'm dancing on the very edge of catastrophe here. But finally, I feel the great fish start to turn. Weakness. It's hammer time. I reel down hard and gradually gain ground, steering the carp successfully back through the island maze towards me. This is a nightmare. The worst possible start. I don't even begin to think about the damage this carp has already done to my chances with the perch. I prepare my net, but the fish is still nowhere near ready. With one giant thump of the tail, it cuts its passage straight up the pond, ploughing away from the islands in my corner, out into the open water. That I don't mind at all. It's well away from my traps and there are no obstacles out there. Keep sustaining the pressure and let the rod do all the work. It will soon start to tire. I'm back in control now. It's just a matter of time. Actually, this might not be that bad after all. If the grand culture of fishing superstition is to be believed, then all that is happening here is that history is repeating itself. This happened last year too. First cast, giant carp. Second cast, giant perch. The fish reveals itself. It is a stunning ghost carp with golden white scales and a dark grey skull pattern framing its head. It's a bit smaller than last year's carp, but for some reason the ghost carp always seems to punch above their weight. I slip it into my landing net first time and walk the fish safely down the pond, as far as possible from my perch spot, and to a place where hopefully it can warn all its carpy mates not to come bothering me up in my corner. Resettling after such chaos takes time. Lines and bait boxes are strewn everywhere. It's important after any big fish that you don't just cast straight back in. Heart rates and water need time to settle back into a rhythm, and hurried casts can result in lost fish and tackle. After that carp, I feel like I'm chasing my shadow, ghosting right back into my missteps and mistakes from last year. I remember clearly my next act a year ago. I flung the worm straight back out before I was properly ready, and not 30 seconds later, the rod tip thumped down hard. I lifted, but I didn't initially feel that familiar perchy fight. I felt a sustained pressure, without quite the reel stripping runs of a truly large carp. A small carp, I suppose then, and bullied it back towards me. It wasn't till it was almost under the rod that I had the first obvious clue that this was in fact a truly massive perch. The rod suddenly buckled down as the fish dived hard for the wooden posts by my feet. I remember leaving my seat at that point, falling dramatically to one knee and leaning right out across the water with my rod outstretched in my hand. The line grated up hard and horrible against the posts, and I was convinced I was about to lose it. But, much to my surprise, the perch erupted on the surface right before me. Time stood still, and unfortunately so did I. I came to my senses at precisely the same time as the giant perch and made a hurried grab for my net, just as the perch turned its giant head. It was so large you could have fitted a tangerine in its mouth, and with a single pump of its tail it brought my rod tip back down with tremendous force. The next scenes unfolded in a bit of a blur. I realised with sheer horror that the line had somehow tangled intractably around the arm of the reel. I tried desperately to free it, but big fish rarely give second chances, and in that split second window of weakness, the giant perch freed itself from the hook and was gone. Forever. It sounds ridiculous, but I bet if I'd never seen that perch reveal itself on the surface, I would have landed it. The realization that I had my dream fish within touching distance caused me to lose all reason and form. I changed from the confident bully into the horrified victim in an instant. It still makes me shudder at the thought. Anyway, you can't let that happen again now, Will, I tell myself for what feels like the millionth time. I catapult out another pouch of maggots and flick the worm back into the danger zone. Ice cool, I refocus. Very sadly, history shows no interest in repeating itself. Several hours later, by the time I finally decide to give up and go home, the mercury has plummeted to such an extreme extent that my landing net has frozen solid to the grass. On the drive home, as my fingers come screaming back to life in front of the van's heaters, I swear blind that this will be my last trip to White Springs this winter. After last year's disaster, I've spent a week of my life traipsing up and down the M4 on a 100-mile round trip, desperately hoping to snare that giant perch again. It has been as torturous as it was futile. I haven't caught a single decent fish. That all has to stop now. If I'm to catch a record, I want it to at least have been fun, not just me sat static at the most boring end of fishing, freezing cold and achieving absolutely nothing. It would be all too easy now to simply blame my venue choice for my own shortcomings as an angler. There is nothing actually wrong with White Springs, and those spectacular perch certainly haven't gone anywhere, but it is every inch the commercial fishery. From its sculpted islands to its trim shrubs and manicured fishing platforms, it is precisely the sort of place I was supposed to be weaning myself off during this challenge. If I'm going to keep coming to places like this, then I may as well just chuck the Wilson Encyclopedia in the lake and carry on catching carp. I can hear what you're all thinking. I bet if you'd landed that big perch, you wouldn't feel that way. Of course I wouldn't, but I didn't, did I? As the frost settled into something of a rhythm and temperatures stabilised once more, the memory of the various White Springs debacles began to fade. I took up a permit with my local angling club and filled my boots on big perch from a remote farmland pond, finally cracking the 2 pounds barrier and snaring more than a dozen fish over 1 pound 8 ounces in one quite remarkable evening. My confidence was restored. I hardly lost a fish that month and felt far more comfortable with the haphazard rhythm of the big perch's fight. In fact, I can quite honestly say I only broke sweat on a couple of occasions. Once, when I accidentally locked the van behind the lake gates and then lost the key, and then experienced my first serious breakdown. And next, while leaving the lake on another occasion, when I blundered directly into the path of a massive boar badger and almost shit my socks. I wasn't closing in on that Wilson mega specimen, though. I knew in my heart of hearts it was probably time to take a long, hard look at Grandad's traditional techniques. Really, as undoubtedly effective as worms clearly still were, I hadn't done anything to update my approach in over 25 years. I'd just picked up from where Grandad had left me, rolling his worms into the giant chest freezer. I began a trawl for new methods and was very surprised to discover that perch fishing was practically everywhere. Multiple blogs, on the covers of magazines, all over the internet forums, and in many, many viral videos. Catching perch suddenly seemed very in, and dare I say, actually, a little bit cool. Without a doubt, the single greatest piece of public relations to come out of the sport has been the impact of light rock fishing, LRF, from Japan. In the past, lure fishing meant shapely chunks of metal, spinners or spoons, and wooden plugs moulded to resemble the features of a wounded baitfish, and pulled through the water in a manner designed to fool predatory fish into a take. The trick of LRF is to take these basics and radically lighten the approach. In this way, new infinitesimally small spinners appeared on the market, alongside thousands of micro lures, jigs and jerkbaits made of ultra-lightweight rubber and malleable plastics in a bewildering array of colours, shapes and designs. The masterstroke of LRF is that it has even made fishing for smaller predatory fish really exciting. For fishermen armed with short rods, matched with lightweight reels and hypersensitive braided lines, even the little, Wasp-like perch are a tantalizing target once again. Their attacks, registering on the subtle line with an extraordinary jarring force, every run, lunge and head shake transmitted down the rod with surgical precision. LRF isn't just for small fish, though. Most of our recent record-breaking perch have been caught using these tactics, and believe me, when you actually do hook into something substantial, the feeling of that first heart-stopping run never leaves you. Thanks to LRF, urban fishing is back with a bang, and it was on those previously overlooked waterways that I decided to focus my gaze now. Armed with a packet of inch-long rubber snow-white lures known as grass minnows, I scanned through a long list of options for a big city stripey. The obvious choice would be somewhere on the Thames. The perch fishing pedigree of this river placed it somewhere among the very best perch rivers in the country. And according to the perch record list, a 6-pound, 4-ounce unclaimed record was landed there just a couple of years ago by a man listed only as Bill. How cool is that? According to reports, he had to be forced into declaring any element of his catch at all. I desperately wanted to meet this Bill, a perch fishing Jedi master to my young Skywalker, but most of all, I wanted to meet his perch. Of course, only a fool would target a river as long as the Thames for just one fish, but Bill's perch was far from the only big one. There's barely a week that passes without a Wilson mega specimen popping up somewhere on that river, either in the press or online, and the overwhelming majority of them are falling to the new LRF techniques. I had only fished the Thames once before, from a town park in the leafy Berkshire town of Pangbourne, but even then I conspired to lose a very big perch that had engulfed a small roach just as I was about to get it into the net. That was a free-to-fish spot, and with a little research I soon found there were actually many more miles of free fishing along other parts of this iconic river. Perfect. It felt too good to be true. I bought a new, ridiculously small rod, coupled with an even smaller reel, and spooled up with braided line. Then I got very overexcited, very prematurely. Within 24 hours, Storm Barney had ripped through the nation, bringing gale-force winds and heavy rains in its wake. That rain didn't let up for a week, and soon nearly every river in Britain had swelled to bursting point. I didn't even need to leave the house to know for sure that the Thames would have gone into a serious state of spate, a sort of turbulent chocolate milkshake condition that would need at least another week to settle back down. The free fishing was irrelevant, and my lightweight gear was useless. I chewed my fingers down to stubs. That's not to say you can't catch fish from flooded rivers. Some of the best catches I've ever made have been in the calm areas and eddies where fish are forced to take refuge from the chaos of the main flow during a spate. But LRF fishing in heavy water isn't much fun at all. Even if you do manage to find clean runs away from all of the storm detritus, getting the fish to see the lure in heavily coloured water is extremely hard, and getting your light gear to behave in a natural way is nigh on impossible. I had an interview in London coming up that was within a stone's throw of the Grand Union Canal. It wasn't a patch of water I knew very well at all. In fact, I could comfortably count on one hand the amount of times I'd even seen it, but I did know that canals are always a sound bet when the weather is rough. Canals had to be constructed to allow for the year-round passage of cargo during Britain's industrial heyday. The canal engineers certainly couldn't afford to let a few drops of rain stop traffic. So, with a deliberately even depth and flow provided by numerous man-made gates, locks and drains, you can get far more fishable water in rough conditions. Plus, these days, with all the canal boats, low-slung bridges and concrete pilings, there are plenty of features for big perch to hide around, and under as well. But the Grand Union Canal? In central London? Really? The catch reports I read were very mixed, and in some cases downright dangerous. News articles detail fishermen who were robbed of all of their gear at knife point, and others who had actually been pushed in by thugs looking for a laugh. The perch stories range from the ludicrous, one man claiming to have landed a 7-pounder from the Paddington area, to the plausible, a head of 3-pounders dwelling somewhere within the deeper locks of Camden. But to get anything more specific than that required a more effective knowledge of code breaking than the employees of Bletchley Park had. I guess I could understand the need for some secrecy. Having put in so much work to locate a fish, you wouldn't then want every jolly perch fisher or poacher from W7 to E6 to descend on your mark and clean up. But some of the anglers had gone to truly ludicrous lengths to hide their knowledge. Pictures of giant perch clutched by men who had blurred or blackened the entire background of their image, and others who had even gone so far as to obscure their own faces, as if they were part of a perch-based witness protection program. I didn't really get it. If you didn't want people to know where you were fishing, then why bother putting up pictures of you with fish on the internet in the first place? Unless, of course, you're just showing off and hyperinflating your own sense of self-importance by blurring your face and background. In which case, why not go the whole hog and come up with an entirely new social media profile to complete your disguise, instead of posting with your actual name, actual address, and actual school leavers details just one mouse click away? What really irritated me on all of these blogs, pages, and sites was the sheer amount of vitriol reserved for people who did not conform to the rules of the perch fishing clique. Anglers who posted pictures with specific details of where their fish were caught were slammed for not caring about the welfare of the fish, and those who held their perch with arms outstretched in pride were ridiculed for making their catch appear bigger than it actually was, as if that matters at all at the end of the day. The worst of the wrath, however, was aimed at those who dared post a picture of their catch with a weight that was not deemed plausible by this extraordinarily sad minority of armchair anglers. I remember one young lad in particular who caught the absolute perch of a lifetime from a town centre pond. It was a fish that looked every inch a record breaker, a glorious, solid-looking perch, which I would happily give away every rod in my household to catch. Doubtless, he was extremely proud of his catch, and quite reasonably thought it might be a good idea to post it on the Perch Fishing Facebook group. However, for daring to post the location, weight, and method of his catch, he was thrown to the virtual lions and torn to absolute shreds. Within the hour, the picture was gone, as was this boy's Facebook profile, and no doubt any intentions he may have had to learn more about perch fishing from the adults. If it happened at that boy's school, they would have all been suspended for bullying, but on this platform, I'm in no doubt it was pats on the back all round for another job well done. That's what the internet is all about, though, these days, isn't it? And so it was. I watched legions of newcomers to the sport turned off for good, derided simply for wanting to publicly celebrate their perch and feel part of this bizarre little club. It had been a while since I'd been in London, but I felt I knew the city fairly well, having lived here for a year in my mid-twenties, a piece of my own history I shared with Grandad. He had actually been part of the engineering team that had helped design the Thames Barrier in the 1970s, a pioneering construction built near Greenwich to stop the city from being flooded in the event of a storm surge or exceptionally high tide. But it's fair to say Grandad revelled in telling anyone and everyone he met about what a truly miserable place he thought our capital city to be. I remember the first time I visited as a teenager, and on returning to the village made the huge mistake of relating to him the following comment by a bus driver. "In London, you're either looking at a shithole or living in one." Grandad, I recall, nodded along sagely, as if Buddha himself had crafted this singular piece of crude wisdom. "Well," he eventually said, "he's right. Lonely too." I swore there and then I would never go to London through choice, but somewhat inevitably, given the lack of entry-level employment opportunities for a budding factual documentarian in the Fens, I ended up in London anyway, and to my great surprise, absolutely fell in love with the place. London, despite its faults, is one of the greatest cities on earth, and don't let anyone tell you otherwise. For me, by day, it may have been, "I simply can't understand why you still stood in shot and not bringing our sandwiches." But by night, I was free to enjoy deliberately long strolls home in the darkness, through the buzzing Caribbean markets of Shepherd's Bush, along the Royal Parklands, and down past the glitzy West London casinos, where I watched Manny Pacquiao knock out Ricky Hatton live from the MGM Grand, and once lost a month's wages in just 20 minutes. For a young man from a small village, simply living in London was like getting my own star on the Hollywood Boulevard. I could not believe I was living in the capital and seeing instantly familiar sights like Tower Bridge, Big Ben and Piccadilly Circus with my own eyes, and not just on TV. It was the sheer scope and cultural diversity of the place that truly blew my socks off, though. London isn't a place at all. It's a million little places, commented Bill Bryson. And I have to say, I wholeheartedly agree. I feasted on all the pleasures to be had by throwing myself fully into this city's life and began to wonder if Grandad had simply been overwhelmed by it all. Of course, it isn't fair to write anywhere off with a sweeping statement, but having now lived in several big cities, I have to say they can dish up a very special brand of isolation if you let them. When faced with such diversity, opportunity and choice, to be incapable of seizing any of it for yourself through no fault of your own is to feel like the loneliest leper in the colony. The city then becomes the problem and will provide evidence for your chosen prejudice wherever you wish to seek it out. As much as I loved and appreciated all the parklands in London, it never once occurred to me that I might be able to fish the canals. In my mind, they were irredeemably dirty, the haunts of pimps and muggers, and certainly not places to be spending any of my free time in. Whenever I peered into them, I saw not near limitless opportunities to fish, but waste and weed, beer bottles and piss, an environment devoid of any life worth looking for. It's extraordinary looking back to think how easily I turned my back on fishing that year. And so it was that the delights of the Grand Union Canal remained hidden from me until today. My alarm sounded at a little past 6 a.m. I was staying with friends right out in East London. Ordinarily, this would pose a real barrier to a day's fishing in the city centre, as just the thought of piling on the underground during rush hour with all my fishing tackle is enough to give me heart palpitations. But that is the beauty of LRF. No one would even have to know. Just what do you wear for an interview when you know you're going to be spending the rest of the day fishing? I suppose the obvious answer would be to favour whichever one of the two activities is more important to you and dress accordingly. But that's a dangerous path for me to be walking down, and one I suspected wouldn't ever lead to an economically sustainable future. So I had opted for a halfway house. Fishing trousers paired with a smart shirt and my fishing jacket to go on top. But within moments of boarding the tube, it became apparent that I had got it very wrong indeed. In the bright light, I realised I had been happily spraying Lynx Africa deodorant over what is quite obviously a large circular patch of fish slime on the breast of my jacket. I smell like a teenage boy who has just rolled along the floor in a fishmonger's and then stuck a shirt on. We pause at Stratford and my aroma wafts in and out of the doors as commuters stream on. A few people scrunch up their noses in disgust, so I do the same, with a shifty sideways glance and attempt to palm the smell off onto some other unfortunate on the tube. Thankfully, I'm ignored. Smells on the tube are simply another inconvenience to add to the thousands of others these Londoners will have to face down today. I wonder who else here might want to go fishing for a half hour, and what a difference it could make to their day. We pull into Liverpool Street Station and dozens of smartphones flicker into life. Emails are coming in. Even down in this hole, you can't escape work. These people don't actually have half an hour. They are 24/7 slaves to their emails and work. I've been in those offices. You procrastinate through half the day but wouldn't dare admit you could get your work done in half the time. You eat your lunch at your desk and then wait to be the last person to leave at the end of the day. You send emails in the middle of the night to give the impression of diligence, when in fact all you're doing is confirming your total servitude to a group of overlords who'll never even notice the extra hours you put in. We're losing out on our leisure time right across British cities, and largely it's a problem of our own making. I moved from this city, worked fewer hours, got out more, and surprisingly got a lot more work done as a result. Capping the mind-bending and inefficient 70 to 80 hour work weeks made me much more focused when I was in work, and much happier when I wasn't. I was largely getting to do what I wanted to do outside of work, which was fish, and I slept much better due to the increase in physical activity and fresh air. I'm determined to prove that it is still possible to go into work, even in our capital city, and find some time to fish somewhere nearby. But it doesn't even need to be fishing. You can do whatever you want to do with your time, as long as it's not illegal and you're back in work on time. The only thing I ask is that if you are a boss, that you don't read this to mean that I'm promoting the idea of fishing in the lunch break purely to increase productivity for your company. This is about my readers escaping your clutches during the break they richly deserve. It's for them, about them, and your work doesn't come into it. In fact, I recommend you try it out for yourself as long as it doesn't become an official work outing, a team bonding exercise, or something else as excruciatingly lame. A man spots my rod, so I give him a little smile. He looks at me with large, doleful, baggy eyes. Get me out of here, they plead. My interview finishes at a very agreeable time. I think it went well. They didn't once mention the smell from my jacket, and I reckon they thought the fishing gear was actually pretty charming. Stepping out of the shiny glass building and onto the Euston Road, it's clear I'm not going to get everything my way today. The heavens open and it starts pitching it down hard. Clearly, Storm Barney hasn't let us go yet. I pull my cap over my eyes and head towards King's Cross Station. In keeping with most areas around major train stations the world over, the immediate vicinity of King's Cross is truly one of London's grimmest areas. It really shouldn't be. The station itself is full of Victorian splendour, with its neat bricks, grand arches and glass facade. And just down the road is the equally stunning St Pancras Renaissance Hotel and British Library. But the fast food restaurants, ugly coffee shops, horns, sirens and shouting give it a feel of a place where people would only ever wish to arrive or leave. Moments later, I felt like I was in an entirely new city. The black atmosphere diminished with every squelching step I took down York Way. There was water around here for sure, and it had already cast its comforting net wide down this street. I popped my head over a low wall, hoping to spot it, but only find rows of parked trains. A little further on, I spy the unmistakable shape of a bridge, but it's got traffic piling over it and doesn't look like a particularly inviting spot for my first look at the canal. You can't mess up your first approach to water. It has to feel right. You've got to give your patch space to display itself in its best finery. Otherwise, you might find yourself writing the water off prematurely and miss out on something truly special. I take the next right down a narrow alley. I'll catch her out further downstream. Soon I'm passing behind a posh business building, and there, at the alley's end, the world opens out splendidly into wonderful calm water. This is Battle Bridge Basin. Victory. It is hemmed in on all sides by upmarket housing developments, and the noise from King's Cross is totally suppressed here, leaving this blissful oasis jutting fully 150 metres inwards from the main flow of the canal. It's wide too, 50 metres across I later learn, and better yet, it has relatively little weed and no obvious no fishing signs. The perfect place to have my first speculative cast. I extend my telescopic travel rod and check the sharpness of the hook point by gently pressing it against the cuticle of my thumbnail. There are not many places to actually cast a clean line. The rows of brightly coloured canal boats on the far side look well worth a chuck, but on this bank I've got about 15 metres of the alley end and a covered walkway leading across a marbled floor at the back of an architectural firm. Still, 15 metres is better than nothing, and there is at least enough room to put a couple of long casts into the centre of Battle Bridge Basin, and probably a couple more along the weeping brickwork running along the water's edge. I'd better get on with it. At any rate, I'm being eyeballed suspiciously by a security guard with biceps like coiled ropes. The grass minnow plops into the drink, and the time it takes to settle on the bottom tells me this place is a hell of a lot deeper than it looks. From this point on, I'm fishing on faith and feel. The braided line and soft rod are incredible. I twitch the minnow through the water and can feel every single bump, nook and cranny as I make my first retrieve. The rain pours on the surface, flattening it and obscuring any potential signs of schooling baitfish. But I don't mind that at all, as the water is painfully clear, so a bit of natural cover plays into my hand and obscures my outline. I'm going to have to box clever today. There's no point taking all my time to cover every single inch of water. The fish are either there or they're not. I need to target specific features. Something that casts a shadow and makes its residents feel safe. A couple of tries in each spot and then move on. Accuracy, a methodical retrieve and determination are the keys to success here. I can't be a river snob either. The perch in this canal are just as likely to be living inside a car tyre as in a bank of reeds. It's only us humans who get really fussy about the look of our real estate. I fish between the canal boats, right along a thick ribbon of duckweed, under my first bridge, round a submerged traffic cone, and along the length of a flatbed trolley. No luck, but I've got to stay confident. Crossing a road out of the basin, I pass a sign giving fishing the thumbs up and immediately feel buoyed. This place just feels right for a fish. The next likely feature is another bridge right opposite the King's Cross Theatre. I'm going to be leaping from bridge to bridge like a troll today. The rain clearly isn't going to stop, so they'll be my only possible shelter, but the artificial darkness will also appeal greatly to the perch. A couple of speculative casts into the murk bring my first proper take, but it's short-lived. A single spirited headshake sees the hook easily disgorged. A pity, but a positive sign for sure. I must be doing something right. I try again, taking care to slow my retrieve right down. And this time the hook finds something far more solid. But this is no fish. I heave hard and get nothing back bar unyielding resistance. Obviously, I've hooked into a heavy piece of solid waste, a trolley, a washing machine, or perhaps something more sinister. I try and change my angle, but there is still no give. This will have to be my first donation to the canal then. I snap the braided line under the strain. The very best of fish live in the hardest places to catch them. Of course they do. They've grown in age and weight by being canny feeders, avoiding bigger predators, and picking the best spots to ambush food. But here that doesn't mean supple tree roots or the soft tendrils from an overhanging bush. This is solid city centre litter dumped off the bridges by the lazy and the feckless. In short, a tackle graveyard. Another cast yields another aborted take. But this extra scrap of evidence allows me to narrow down the size and location of the fish. It's a small perch for sure, hidden somewhere tight against the heavily graffitied far wall. There's no walkway over there, so it's clear of human debris, but right in the middle of the canal is a ceiling fan and a billowing white sack. It's a tough cast. I steady myself. I reckon I've got one more crack at this before the little fish spooks for good. Any luck, mate? Comes a thick West African accent from over my shoulder. I turn to meet a large man in full train guard uniform, his head topped with an immaculate black cap. Not yet, mate. Just had a take down here, but I missed it, I think. We both look into the water. Yeah, there's fish here all right. He leans over the railing, hoping to spot one on demand, and then gobs into the canal. It all depends on the weather. I ask about his job, and it turns out he isn't a train guard at all. It's just a good, thick coat and a snappy hat, don't you think? I nod in approval and smile. I haven't heard the word snappy for over 20 years. Plus, you get plenty respect on the train. He laughs heartily. My new friend and I both agree that there is a little perch under the bridge, but after a couple more casts, we surmise he's probably not going to get caught today. He shuffles off, and so do I. Downstream, passing Camley Street Natural Park, which had a couple of volunteers gamely tending to the shrubbery in the torrential rain, and on into my first lock. St. Pancras Lock is really very striking. A cute little whitewashed cottage guards the thick oaken lock gates, and a string of canal boats line up along my side of the bank. Each boat is a tiny commercial venture in itself. There are a bookshop, a garden store selling shrubs, even a floating coffee and cake shop and micro theatre. I feel like I've been transported to the Cotswolds or the Norfolk Broads. The canal boat life looks undeniably quaint, and dare I say, quite attractive. I wish I'd thought of this when I was living here. Sadly, I've only been on a canal boat once. It was on a stag do along a stretch of this very canal, much further upstream, somewhere between Leighton Buzzard and Milton Keynes. But let me tell you, you get a very different experience with 30 drunken blokes dressed as pirates from the one you would on board the artisan boats of King's Cross. Still, it was enough to let me know that the canal boat life probably isn't for me after all. It's cramped in there, with or without Long John Silver hogging the toilet, and it gets very cold in the mornings when you wake up at water level. I forsake the immensely tempting cake and coffee and keep heading downstream in search of the elusive first fish. Under a large railway bridge, I finally get a rattling take that hangs on. After a short fight, I've got a spiky London prince in my fingertips. A picture-perfect perch with beautiful markings. It has probably never seen a hook. I gently ease him back and recast. Another bite. This could be the mother load. The next perch is near identical to the first, as is the next, and then I lose my hook on some lumpen piece of subaquan detritus. That's the game. Every other cast is a bite, and everyone in between is a snag. I've got to keep it slow and steady to induce a take, but there's always that risk of snaring up. It's well worth it, though. There's a pod of perch hunting in here for sure. Next cast, I hook a much better fish that strips line from the reel, races through the legs of an office chair, and manages to transplant my hook into the metalwork. Bad news. I curse my luck. I've heard it said that big perch are the brainiest of all freshwater fish, and I know a good few anglers who always release them well away from their fishing mark, firm in the belief that a big one can get an entire shoal to back off the feed for the rest of the day, if they so wish. I rest the swim for 5 minutes. A couple of long trains shake the thick grey girders above my head, displacing a shower of pigeon poo into the water. I recast and bang! The fish are right back on it again. For a while I'm getting savage bites, but I just can't seem to hook up. I try a firmer strike on the next take and the rod buckles down under an immense weight. This time it's animate and begins to move steadily downstream. There's no jagging fight to be had here. I feel almost certain I've just hooked into a really big pike. My tackle is light, so I've got to be very careful now. But equally, I can't just let this fish dictate terms. I walk downstream and everything goes solid once more. For a moment, I think I've been snagged up by the fish again. But then, slowly, carefully, it starts moving upwards, towards me. Hands shaking with adrenaline, I reach into my pocket and fish out my pike glove. I might only get one crack at this. You take it? An extremely drunk man, who tells me he is from Poland, clutches his can of Tyski lager and laughs so hard it echoes like thunder around the bridge walls. I try again to get my hook out of the sleeve of the suit jacket. Some bloody pike that turned out to be. Maybe you sell at fishmongers, get good price. There are actual tears streaming down the Polish man's face now, and he even starts to choke. For a second I wonder if he's having a heart attack, but he fortifies himself with a generous swig from his can of lager. Yeah, very funny, mate. I try to conceal the rage gnawing my insides and with a hard yank finally free my hook. I didn't even see this man coming as I was hauling up the coat. It's as if he's just materialised from the water like a large drunken canal spirit. The jacket slopes back into the murk where I can't retrieve it. It hangs there, with one arm in the air, like a creepy scene from an Asian horror movie. An indistinct demon crawling out of the water ready to feed on livers. Mine, obviously, not the Polish man's. The very next cast brings me another perch. I take it. I turn to see my new friend. He's not laughing anymore. In fact, he's deadly serious, eyeing me glassily with one fat red hand outstretched towards me. No, mate, I say casually. It really should go back. I reach under the railing ready to place it in the water. And feel his hand pressing heavily onto my shoulder. No, he leans in. I eat it. His hot, drunk breath slaps my face like a barroom drip tray, and I realise I'm in a bit of a bind. On the one hand, I've got the totally unnecessary and near-certain death of a tiny fish from a recovering canal, and on the other, I've got this man bearing down on me with the real possibility of violence should I not concede to his demand. With little time at my disposal, I attempt to make it look like I just dropped the perch back in by accident. You fucking English idiot! The man explodes, screaming with such force I almost jump into the canal in terror. He throws both hands to the heavens and hurls his can high into the air until it comes crashing down in the middle of the canal with an immense splash. Fishing's over then, I think to myself, before rationalising that I'm probably about to get beaten up very badly. Look, I'm sorry, mate. The ability to reason with drunks has long been a skill I admire. My landlord friend tells me the trick is to speak to them like they are 3 years old. I just think the fish should go back. It was only a little one anyway. This time round, I place my hand on his shoulder. It was only little. I've had bigger fish fingers, yet he looks at me like I've just insulted his wife. Pizda! He screams, inches from my face before storming off. Later, I check Google Translate and discover he was not actually asking me to buy him an alternative dinner. I decided it was probably best to head down to the next bridge after that. Perch after perch come to my line until I've had at least a dozen in 10 minutes. Leaning with my back to an impressive-looking piece of skull graffiti, I attempt a massive cast and watch my lure arch through the air to near-certain fish. However, just as the hook strikes the water, I notice two approaching policemen. Instinctively, I just know it's me they're after. "Any luck so far?" they say in unison. They look almost identical, with neatly trimmed ginger beards and a slightly unnaturally chummy disposition that makes me feel deeply uncomfortable. Yeah, quite a few perch," I stammer, trying to look as not guilty as possible. I've always been nervous around the police, not because I've ever done anything really wrong, but because my mum's dad used to find it funny to grab me in a headlock and shout, "I've got him, officer," at the top of his voice whenever he saw a police car. That feeling of latent criminality just kind of stuck with me. "Got your permit then, have you?" they inquire with a well-practiced airiness. I actually do, of course, and happily present my rod licence. If that is all this is about, then I should be back fishing in seconds, I think. "Nah." They both look at me sternly. "Oh, shit. We want your Canal and River Trust permit." I don't have one. I don't even know what one is. I'd simply assumed it was free fishing on this stretch of canal. The first time I've heard of this permit is right here, right now, in front of the Thompson Twins Ginger Edition. I shuffle nervously and think about what prison might be like. "I'm really sorry, lads. I honestly didn't know. I thought it was free fishing," I proffer desperately, appealing to their sense of compassion by being completely honest. They consider my words, obviously sizing up the extent of my law-breaking behaviour. Then, without warning, they suddenly change tack. "Look, we really don't care, mate. Between you and me, this is a total ball ache," answers one, looking at his feet sheepishly. "But you've picked the wrong day to try this sort of stunt. The Canal and River Trust are actually here today," continued the other. They both then give a worried glance over their shoulders. "Jesus, I think. Who are these guys? If they've got the police anxious, they must be the canal equivalent of the SAS. "Okay, guys, I'm not looking for any trouble. I'll sling my hook." I hope that little joke at the end there might crack a sympathetic smile, but I'm sadly misguided. "Good," they say in harmony, before clicking their heels together and heading back in the opposite direction. I don't feel much like risking another cast after that, and head back to King's Cross with the deeply satisfying smell of perch on my hands. I've already had a brilliant day. I eventually made it back home, looked up the Canal and River Trust, and discovered, to my eternal shame, that it was only £20 for a permit that covered this section of the Grand Union Canal, and a great many other canals right across the UK as well, for an entire year. They had an email address for contact, so with a little Dutch courage, I fired off a few words requesting a chat. I noticed I had another email in my inbox. It was from the interview earlier that morning, and it informed me that I hadn't got the gig. Maybe taking your rods to work isn't always the greatest move after all. John Ellis had such a nice lilting accent and calm manner that I struggled to associate him with the threat of spectacular violence over the wrong fishing permit, but I thought it was best to play my cards very carefully. Whenever I've encountered the people who work the closest with nature, they almost always exude a zen-like sense of eternal perspective. It is as if they have already realised their life's work will last long beyond their graves, and that's just fine, thanks. It is more than just a job to these people, and their knowledge of their area is usually encyclopedic. And so it was with John, the National Fisheries and Angling Manager for the Canal and Rivers Trust. "We look after every water the CRT owns. That's some 2,000 plus miles of canals and 70-odd still waters right across the UK," he effuses. "Last year, there were 61,000 members of our canal clubs, making us the biggest owner of canal fishing rights in the UK." I was far too ashamed to attempt a question about the number of people that fish without permits. Plus, I didn't want to stop John in full flow. The second thing we do is asset management, looking after the fish stocks, the engineering works, repairing riverbeds or draining the locks, right up to fish rescue. when we've had to drain a canal or temporarily relocate fish. My ears pricked right up next to the phone receiver. Really, John? So it's probably fair to say then that if there was, say, a record fish to be had from a canal, then you would be the man to ask, I gently probed. Absolutely, he replied enthusiastically as I fist-punched the air. On the Grand Union Canal, for example, just up by the Watford Gap service stations, we found the most massive eel. It was £8.2. I was gobsmacked. That is basically an anaconda. I made a note to hit that very spot later in the year for eels. It wasn't alone, actually, continued John, perhaps mistaking the silence on the line for indifference from my end. There was another with it, which weighed £6.14. Jesus Christ, John, I exclaimed. That's two fish, probably several feet in length, in one stretch of canal. I was on the verge of losing it, but there was more to come. They weren't just in the same stretch of canal, Will. They were both in the same lock, together, trapped. I was basically beside myself. This was a truly astonishing piece of information. If you are interested in eels, I interrupted him, I am, John, very interested. Well, he continued, then you've just got to try the Monmouth and Brecon Canal. There's plenty of £2 fish in there. It's practically paved with the things. Who knows how big they'll go? But I'll tell you what else. Swansea Canal near to you is absolutely full of brook lamprey as well. I could scarcely believe what I was hearing. The brook lamprey from my childhood had returned, thriving in another body of turbid water. Perhaps it wasn't such a rare occurrence as I first thought. In September, we did some dredging works to remove the silt and caught over 1,000 in just one 400-metre stretch. They are thriving. They just love the silt, John continued with a schoolboy's enthusiasm. Our chat went on at a feverish pace, and by the time we were through his list of potentially record-breaking canals, I thought my writing hand was going to fall off. 15-pound slab-sided bream from the Regent's Canal, pike over 30 pounds in the Ashby and Coventry canals, giant perch from the Leeds and Liverpool. It was quite conceivable that I could have attempted this entire challenge from Britain's canal systems alone. However, there was one irrefutable and unavoidable detail. Although the heavyweights in themselves were undeniable, the sheer number of big individual fish coming out of the commercially stocked lakes far outstripped those that came from the canals. Well, the management of those commercials is always going to have a big impact on the weight of any fish. What with all those piles of protein-rich baits fed in just to attract the carp? There was a pause on the line. I knew what John wanted to say next. It was obvious. But ask yourself this, Will. Would you feel a greater sense of achievement catching a known giant artificially reared in a pond, or a wild unknown that's built the foundation of its size and strength purely on its own cunning and guile? For years, the record tench came from a canal, John lamented. It was from the Grand Union Canal's Leicester line. That record stood right through till the 1960s. £7 something it was. But today, the tench record stands at over £15, over double the size of the record that once stood for decades. Commercials had changed everything. Even I had caught a tench over £7 from a commercial fishery in the past. A great fish without doubt, but I had no idea it would have once been a new national record. I don't even think I thought to photograph it. It's possible that the canals could still turn up a record one day. I don't believe those big eels will find their way out of the canal and back to the sea too easily. And canal catches have never been better, you know. But without doubt, the biggest threat to our canals is the lack of anglers, continued John flatly. There are many, many more people choosing to seek their thrills from commercial fisheries, and some of our best canals are falling into a state of serious neglect. John believed the mentality of the angler had fundamentally altered. We're missing a whole generation of people that learnt to fish on the canals. I grew up on the Hangothling Canal. It cost me my place in medical school, he quipped. But all the kids want is the guarantee of big fish these days. I offer my own theory that most people, including myself once, didn't actually see the city canal as a place where fish live. That we have this prevailing myth that a lot of them are completely devoid of life. Yes, John agrees. Then we make these school visits and netting trips and the kids are absolutely amazed. It'd been fascinating chatting to John, but also Really quite sad to think that this iconic natural resource was falling into a state of such serious disrepair through little more than neglect and ignorance.